Welcome to Witchlit, a place to talk about the craft of writing and writing the craft. I'm your host, Victoria Rashke, author, publisher, witch, and nosy Scorpio. Thank you for downloading or listening to this special episode of Witchlit. I'm going to tell you here at the top, this is a promo episode for my new book, Verona Green, A Story of Art and Magic, out by Thousand Volt Press. I'm going to read you the first chapter today as kind of a special treat. And hey, you might be interested in reading this book. And there'll be details about that at the end. But in the meantime, enjoy. Verona Green by Victoria Rashke, Chapter 1. How happy I would be for this commission to be complete, both for the lady's money and for her absence from my house. Along with her disagreeable nature, she carried the peculiar sweetness of onions gone to rot, making my wife glad to see the back of her and her odor at the end of each sitting. The departing afternoon light took its warmth with it, and even the fire recently stoked couldn't drive out the chill setting in for the night. I pulled my blanket tighter around my shoulders, determined to finish the Verona green underpainting of my patron's hand. She sat, stiff-backed, in the ornate chair she had delivered from her manor across the canal, but she had become bored almost immediately upon sitting, slowing the day's progress with frequent breaks for a warm drink or to relieve herself. One would think a woman bent on surprising her husband with this gift would be more eager to have it completed. "We are finished," she said as she stood, smoothing the front of her heavy vermilion gown. "The light has gone and I would return home." "Of course," I said, setting the palette aside. I moved to drape the portrait with an oilcloth I had fashioned to keep dust and soot from settling on the wet paint between our sessions. "May I, before you cover it?" the lady asked as she made to look around the easel. I quickly settled the cover over. "I would you wait until it is completed." She gave me a sour look I am certain her own husband often saw and turned to leave without further conversation. After exchanging a few words of departure with my wife, she offered a sharpish instruction to her groomsmen in the street outside. When she had gone, I lifted the cover by half and made an attempt to complete the underpainting of the lady's thumb before my work and the uncharitable thoughts about my patroness were interrupted. "Verity, earth to verity." My friend George's voice cut through the vision of the painter's studio, darkening to the gloom of evening, and brought me back into the artificially bright restoration lab of the New Amsterdam Museum of Art. It was well past dark in New York, and I had to blink a few times to readjust to the present. The aromas of the painter's supper being prepared lingered, making my stomach growl. I looked up into George's face to find her staring at me, concern etched in the line between her eyebrows. She leaned in close, though we were alone, and stage whispered in my ear, "You were gone, weren't you?" I mumbled a yes at her, noticing the change to the painting on the easel. Instead of restoring the bits of oil and pigment lost over time, I had completely changed the lay of the frumpy woman's hands, turning the wrist so her fingers grasped the other wrist instead of laying neatly, properly folded together on the fine crimson fabric of her dress. Well, shit. I hadn't had an episode in public since college and never at work. Maybe I wasn't sleeping enough, or maybe I needed to do better about keeping my personal wards up. Whatever it was, I needed to get to the bottom of it because this wasn't something that could happen again. George looked at the portrait more closely, mock horror spreading from the upturned corners of her mouth to her raised eyebrows. With her best fake downmarket London accent, she said, "Well, you've bollocked that up." She knew as well as I did that the paints I used were acrylic-based conservator medium, and though they had already dried, I could remove the overpainting without damaging the original underneath. No one would be the wiser. I figured George, per her usual, was using humor to deflect from the fact that I'd come dangerously close to revealing myself to co-workers or getting myself hauled off to the hospital in a catatonic-looking state. I turned to the cabinet behind me for the necessary swabs for removing the acrylic paint. "That'll be fun cleaning, but you don't have time to do it now. We have a date." She tapped her wrist where her watch would be. I had completely forgotten that in George's ongoing quest to find us both some companionship, though I've had my fill of relationships, thank you, she'd set us up on another double date. She met her prospects on a dating app and then insisted they find a second for a double date if they wanted to meet her. So far, these outings had yielded only lackluster conversation and the occasional free drink. "What have you got on under that lab coat?" George lifted the lapel to inspect my navy work trousers and russet-colored blouse patterned with stylized bees. "I guess that will do." "What?" It wasn't like she was dragging me from the studio at the farm in paint-splattered coveralls. George rolled her eyes before wandering away to peek at the other projects in the studio. Everyone had gone for the day while I had been on a time-traveling journey as an obscure 17th-century Dutch portraitist with his patroness of the merchant class. I took a cue from D. de Graaf, whoever he had been, and covered the canvas with an odd piece of linen. It wouldn't stick to the varnish or freshly painted area, as the acrylic medium we used dried without tackiness. It made the paints a little more difficult to work with than oil-based mediums, but they floated on top of the varnish, separating the restoration from the original. I put my palette in the drawer, labeled with a piece of peeling masking tape that read V. Green, to the confusion of restoration interns looking for Verona green or Terra Vert pigment. I rinsed my brushes at the shop sink. George stopped me before I got to the door to point out that I still had my lab coat on and to pull an errant paintbrush out of the messy bun on top of my head. I frowned at the evidence of a bad habit and walked back to the sink to rinse the brush before placing it with the others to dry. Glancing at the obvious covering on my work, I hoped no one got curious over the weekend and discovered my extracurricular handiwork. It wasn't that big a deal, but the painting made me uneasy now. What about it had made me slip so easily into the painter's past? George and I checked out with the night security desk and launched ourselves into the early December cold. The New Amsterdam Museum of Art takes up a sprawling footprint on Fifth Avenue, and the streets nearby are dotted with galleries, shops, and eateries. The occasional magical practitioner makes grandiose promises from back doors hidden in the alleys. George usually planned to meet our dates at a nearby artsy bar, but tonight we were to meet our evening's companions, Adrian something French and his friend whose name George had blanked on aside from it being Eastern European, at a pub in the West Village closer to her apartment. George hailed a cab, having offered to spring for it, and we arrived 5 fashionable minutes late at an establishment where no one appeared to be waiting outside for us. I'd expected some type of hipster bar with industrial lighting and leather-aproned mixologists, but we had been invited to a surprisingly authentic-looking London-style pub, complete with an after-work crowd that packed the bar and booths. I didn't even know this place existed, but given how little time I spent out in the city, that wasn't too much of a surprise. Inside, shiny plastic garland and twinkling lights had been tacked around the bar back, reminding me of the pub we'd haunted at uni that kept their Christmas decorations up until March, sometimes with an errant bat from Halloween festooned with a tiny Santa hat. It was the week after Thanksgiving, but I had to wonder if these twinkly lights were also a permanent fixture. "Maybe we got here first," I said, looking around for anyone else who looked to be searching faces. Everyone was deep in either conversation or their phone screens. George's cell pinged in her hand, and she held it up for me to see the screen. "They're in the snug." "There's a snug?" I don't think I'd ever seen an American pub that actually had one, or if they did, they definitely didn't call it that. The barkeep pointed us toward a door that I would have guessed led to the kitchen or a storage closet. The snug was dimly lit and much quieter, with 4 small tables occupied by a white couple celebrating with champagne, a baby-faced priest drinking a pint alone, reading a folded-over tabloid with a bold headline asking, "Are witches teaching your children?" 4 women with faded summer tans, mindlessly stirring neon cocktails as they chatted, and 2 white guys, a pint each of amber-colored ale half-drained in front of them. I assumed they were our dates. They stood when we came in, refreshing, as the last 2 had had to be pried away from their stock ticker apps to even say hello. The taller one had long dark hair and a full beard, both going gray with sexy gravitas. Guessing, I would have said he was mid to late 40s, and the way he filled out a sweater and jeans spoke more of physical labor than desk jockeying. The shorter one was clean-shaven with jet black curly hair cut like Gabriel Byrne's in his rakish younger days. Leaner than his companion, he dressed in tailored clothes that quietly broadcast wealth. Both men looked like they spent a lot of time in the sun, and I had no idea which one was Adrian. George extended her hand to the shorter man, and I smiled to myself. That meant the taller one was the second. Lucky me, for once. I hoped against experience that he'd be able to string a few words together. Adrian, please meet my friend, Verity Green. George pulled me closer to the table as she said it. Adrian nodded and shook my hand. My pleasure, Adrian Trevier. Very French name, very New York accent, and zero magic. And this is my colleague, Matthias Balak. Georgina Byrne-Jones, but please call me George. George shook hands with Mr. Balak, whose first name I had missed. When he offered me his hand, I got the shock of a fellow magic user and a funny kind of warmth flowing up my arm. I could often tell another witch or magician by their presence, but sometimes the magic was discreet enough or the environment chaotic enough that it required touch. I doubt that I covered my surprise as Mr. Balak's eyes showed his amusement. He'd spotted me too. I'm sorry. I didn't catch her first name, I said, finding it difficult not to stare at him. He had the woo. I had no idea what he could do with it, but now that I was tuned in, he gave off the bass note vibe of very old magic, almost always a complication. Mr. Balak leaned over and close to my ear, said his name again in two distinct syllables. Mat-yaj. Think mat with an ah sound and stress yaj like you say garage. Definitely not a New York accent, but something buttery and cello-like enough to send a tingle down my spine. Adrian gestured to the empty chairs. What would you like to drink? I pointed at their ales. Those look good. Same, said George, while wriggling out of her trench. Adrian dealt with both our coats before disappearing into the main bar. So, Matyaj, Adrian said you are from Slovakia? George asked, giving him her interested but not flirtatious attention. She gave me a wink, making me wonder if she'd picked up on his magic, too. Matyaj chuckled softly. No, I'm from Slovenia, a bit further south. The whole world had reason to know exactly where Slovenia was, magical types especially. George recovered from our awkward silence at his correction. Sorry, I'm sure you get that a lot. I was sure most people immediately asked if he'd been there when the storm happened, but neither of us did. He nodded and smiled, no harm done, and I would have sworn his eyes even twinkled. Adrian, bless him, came back quickly, two ales in hand. I don't remember what we talked about after that because I kept sneaking glances at Matyaj, which he caught every time. After all the general chit-chat subjects had been covered, Adrian suggested we extend our evening to dinner at a restaurant around the corner. No one objected, and we walked there together, George and I having been graciously helped back into our coats. Between the shared appetizer and the first course, I left my wine glass to warm. Things were going entirely too well on both sides of the table, and I needed to keep my head screwed on straight. George had given Adrian that smitten smile of hers that I could clock from space. And by dessert, she and Adrian might as well have been on Mars, for all they talked to Matyaj and me. Between us, we had already established that I worked at NAMA with George, and that she and I had met at Central St. Martin's and found our way to New York after grad school. He worked in historic preservation and had moved to New York in the past year. I didn't talk about my family, and I avoided asking about his so as not to broach the subject. There was attraction, not that it mattered. I only went on these dates to humor George, and as she and I joked, to keep her from getting kidnapped. I wasn't looking to shack up. I'd had my share of past troubles with men, a man in particular, and I was certainly not looking for whatever trouble Matyaj Balak and his old woo might bring. Verity, that's an unusual name for an American. Matyaj took a sip of wine, the burgundy momentarily staining his lips as his gaze drilled in like an expert interviewer's. My father chose it. He's English. It's more common there, though still unusual. I hope that was succinct enough to cut off that particular line of questioning. The downside of minimalist modern restaurants, a aside from zero sound dampening, is there is no plush booth to sink into and hide long enough to get your bearings. It suits you. In Latin, it means he was interrupted by the return of our server with the check. Adrian took it without brooking any protests. The server was sent off with what looked like a generous cash tip, and the clinks and humming chatter of the restaurant filled the silence between us momentarily. George is coming over to mine for a drink. Any other takers? Adrian asked out of politeness, and Matyaj and I refused out of the same. As we got up to leave, Adrian leaned across the table, put his hands on my shoulder, and said, "You're in good hands." He touched me just long enough for me to sense he meant what he said. My watered-down form of empathic touch, which amounted to being able to sense someone's sincerity and what I would call very intermittent telekinesis, had been the storm's gifts to me. Some magic folks had gotten juiced up a bit, like George and her astral travel skills, and some of us got brand new abilities, though not always good or especially useful ones. Adrian's sincerity aside, I wasn't worried about Matyaj being dangerous, even though he was a magic user, or that I couldn't find my own way home, but it was possible my concern about finding my date attractive for once showed. Outside the restaurant, Adrian and George waved goodbye and got into a waiting car, more proof that Adrian had tailored clothes and a driver kind of money. Their departure left Matyaj and me standing in the cold, hesitating about what to do or say next. "What were you saying about Latin earlier?" I asked. I wasn't ready to call it a night, even though that was probably the best idea. I was intrigued, despite myself. "Verdi, in Latin, veritas, truth," he smiled. It's surprising how few people brought up my first name. Most preferred to comment on my last being green and that I'm a painter, as if no one had ever pointed that out to me before. I doubt that was part of the decision. My father wanted his American children to have very English names, inescapably so. My brother's name was Percival. Does Matyaj have a Latin secret? Better turn this line of questioning back around. Trying to explain my family on a first date was not the best way to get a second one. Wait, did I want a second one? "Not really. It's biblical. In English, I would be Matthew," he smiled. "Definitely not as interesting to English speakers, I'm sure." He looked down the street and back to me. "Share a taxi?" "It's a 10-minute walk," I said. I crashed with George at her apartment during the week and took the train up to my place on the weekends. "I can walk with you." There might have been more on offer in his words, but I was comically bad at being able to tell. I wasn't going to tell him that I found him attractive and in possession of many of the qualities, physically at least, I would want in someone if I wanted anyone, but I hesitated in turning down his offer outright. "I would just like to see you home safe," when he smiled, his eyes crinkled at the corners. "Sure. But who will see you safely home?" It was impossible not to smile back. "My place isn't far either," he said, and offered me his arm. I took it, unused to the old-fashioned mannerism, but charmed nonetheless. He talked about his work with Adrian restoring a historic brownstone in Brooklyn that was to become a cultural center. His passion for the project was clear, and I found myself asking questions about sourcing conservation-grade materials, even though I really wanted to ask him if he'd been in Slovenia during the storm. I thought he'd picked up on my woo, but I didn't want to confirm it. Mentioning the storm would either do that, or it could make him think I was one of the new great awakening religious zealots. The city hadn't drawn many of them, but anyone in New York longer than a day had seen the congregations of "Turn away Satan's minions" and "Cast out the witches among us" sign holders at corners in every borough. When we got to my stoop, there was another hesitation in our banter. He leaned in to kiss me, and for once, in a very long while, I didn't turn away. His lips brushed my cheek close to my ear as he asked if he could call me the next day. I nodded and dashed up the steps while he waited on the sidewalk to make sure I got in okay. He waved once I was inside and headed back the way we came. A teeny voice in my head chided me for being so closed up. Closed up, yes. And for good reason. Prudish? No. Matyaj had set things stirring that had been quiet for a long time, and I didn't like it, or at least I tried to convince myself I didn't. George didn't come home before I went to bed. Good for her, I guess. but her slumber parties didn't always translate into second dates either, though she often wanted them to. After a night of dreams of Matyaj that would make a sailor blush, interspersed with nightmares of me getting fired from my heavy-handed touch on the restoration, even in my dreams, I couldn't just let go and have a good time. I woke up agitated, whether out of worry about the painting or horniness for Matyaj or both. I envied George the ability to simply see where the wind would take her that day and not sweat the ride. Instead of staying curled up in bed, which I was certain she was doing with last night's date, I got up, made coffee, and set about leaving the city for the rest of the weekend. There wasn't much to pack except Hilma. I kept a work wardrobe, seconds of all my toiletries, and a small working altar at George's. It was a 2 hours and change trip from Penn Station to Wiltwyck, and another 45 minutes by car to get home. Even catching the earliest train on a Saturday, I would lose most of the morning light in the studio there. But going up wouldn't be a complete loss, as I had things to tackle over the weekend besides painting, like beefing up my personal wards again after the slip at work. Messenger bag and cat carrier secured, I walked to the station gathering wool until my thoughts settled again on the portrait restoration. My assignment was to touch up the missing paint where the canvas had worn through over the centuries and to fill in a larger portion of the back of the subject's hand where an earlier bad repair job of a puncture had caused significant paint loss. Instead, I had changed the whole position of the hand and repainted the terra verte underlayer as Dee DeGraff must have done before layering red and golden ochres with lead white to create the balance of warm and cool halftones reflecting the subject's fair skin, an earlier Renaissance technique called verdaccio. It led to many paintings of saints looking green enough to vomit when the fugitive red lake they used faded, leaving the light, fast green earth pigment exposed. De Graaf had learned to use a more permanent red. I'd never even heard of him, but now I knew this woman he had painted was a troublesome client and an impatient sitter. I had been in his body in 17th century Amsterdam and had my own whiff of her rotted root vegetable smell. No wonder he wanted to forgo the demure convention of folded hands for a more aggressive grasping pose. I still had a few questions about how that part of my magic worked, but there weren't any handbooks on not quite time travel through artwork available, and there definitely wasn't anyone I could ask. My gift wasn't common, even among witches. The aspect of it that bothered me most was the thought that De Graaf and the others over the years had also been in my body and what that could mean. It was part of why I'd worked so hard to make sure it didn't happen and why it bothered me so much that this painting had taken me back for so long. I would have walked right by the entrance to Penn Station if I hadn't been buffeted back into awareness by a man exiting in enough of a rush to dismiss my solid presence in his path. While getting untangled from each other, I got a nose full of paint thinner off his clothes. He was gone too quickly for even a reflexive apology, and the collision faded from my thoughts before I boarded the train. Thanks for listening to this special episode of Witchlit, a promo for my new book, Verota Green, A Story of Art and Magic. This has been a labor of love project that's taken me 3 years to write. And I'm excited it's going to be in the world. If you would like to read the rest of the book, the audiobook is not available yet. I don't know when that's going to happen. But if you would like to read the rest of the book, it's available as an ebook or a print copy wherever you buy books. If they don't have it in stock, you can order it. They can order it from the Ingram catalog. Or you can purchase it directly from Thousand Volt Press and I will sign it for you. And you can do that at thousandvoltpress.com/shop. Where you can also find other books by Thousand Volt Press, including Yvonne A. Burroughs' Changing Paths, which came out earlier this year, and Conjuring the Commonplace by Lane Fuller and Corey Thomas Hutchison, that also came out earlier this year. And I'd love for you to pick up their books or my book or all of them. And just thanks for your support of the podcast and for witchy writers in general. Witchlit is a production of Thousand Volt Press and is edited by Julian Rashke. Our intro music is Cosmic Glow by Andrew Kay, and our outro music is Voices by Alexander Shinekar. Transcripts and all our previous episodes are available at witchlitpod.com, and you can follow us on Instagram at witchlitpod. Please help other witches find us by leaving a rating or review wherever you listen to podcasts. Thank you for listening to and reading Witchlit.